Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. 1.3 billion people have been on lockdown in India for more than a week. Millions of poor, low-paid internal migrant workers were far from home when the announcement was made. They say they are hungry. Many are trapped. Al Jazeera reports that thousands fled on foot to their villages, leading to the death of at least 20 people. Joining us with the latest from Calcutta is Sandeep Roy, journalist and author of the novel Don't Let Him Know. Hi, Sandeep. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Good to be back.
Wow. It's great to hear you, Sandeep. And we found a great line. First of all, how are you and your family doing?
I guess in many ways we are among the lucky ones because for us, a lockdown is more of an inconvenience than an emergency. The city has been locked down. So I actually, you know, people have not been able to go out except for essential services for over a week now. Most shops and businesses and all of that is closed. The city is strangely quiet. Every now and then a vegetable vendor will come around. So some of those services are resuming, but in the initial days of the lockdown, it was really tough because police were sort of indiscriminately beating up anybody they could find on the street. So it could be some poor guy who was just selling vegetables on his pushcart, and food is supposed to be an essential service that should remain open. But so for the longest time, even people who had sort of grocery delivery services and things, and so they were unable to send their delivery persons out with the groceries because they were getting stopped and beaten up by police who were just trying to empty out the street. I mean, as you said, there's 1.3 billion people in the country. To suddenly get 1.3 billion people behind doors is no mean task. But obviously in a city, things finally get streamlined, processes eventually start stumbling and working. But as we saw with the migrants, there are a lot of people who fall between the cracks.
Yeah, exactly. And Sandeep, we read a number of articles by Yahoo and other news organizations about this lockdown being implemented with an iron fist. So to your knowledge, I mean, are people still being stopped and beaten up, or has that mostly stopped?
It depends on where you're going. There have still been, I think there's much less of that happening right now. They've been really trying to get the word out to people. Like every television newscast you hear, the newscaster at some point will stop and say, please take this lockdown seriously and stay at home, and making sure that people get the message. In Calcutta, things seem to be a little more relaxed in some ways. You know, people will go out to get vegetables. You'll see most people wearing some kind of mask, whether that's useful or not. People don't have masks. You know, a lot of people just don't have masks, so they are using a handkerchief or something over their face. And the government has said that the migrants who were on the road in the thousands, that there are no migrants on the road anymore, that either they have been put into buses and sent to the villages they're from, or they have been put into shelters in the cities where they have been working. But it's another matter of fact as to how well those centers operate and whether social distancing is being observed. And on a funny sort of ironical note, in this country, which is all about social connections, it's really weird to see people try and practice social distancing. So the chief minister of the state I'm in Kolkata, the chief minister, who is sort of like the governor of California would be, she has literally been out on the streets drawing chalk circles on the sidewalk in front of grocery stores to try and teach people where to stand in order to maintain a social distance between them. So she's, I mean, this is more than you could say hands-on. She's literally drawing them on the street. And people, you know, are still getting used to that. I've seen a rather funny and sad picture of a place where it's really hot. And so they've drawn these chalk circles on the street, and everybody has placed their bag or something on one of the chalk circles to sort of mark their spot in the line. And then they all clustered together in the shade, defying all norms of social distancing. So, you know, these are messages that are difficult to get into people's head. But the fact is, when a lot of people are struggling to make food, you know, when the choice is whether I starve today versus whether I might catch the coronavirus somewhere down the line, many people are sometimes will think we'll take our chances with the virus because right now, today, I have a family to feed.
Wow. We'll talk more about that in a minute, Sandeep, but I also wanted to talk with you about what is happening in India. As you know, here in the United States, there's still a major lack of testing. There's a shortage of ventilators and hospital beds, protective equipment for health workers. What is the situation like in India, first off, when it comes to testing?
The testing has always been very low. I mean, that has been one of the huge problems where people say that in terms of actual number of cases, India is, for a country of 1.3 billion, India is not that high. Right now, I think there's about 2,300 or so positive cases, and the death toll is in the 50s or, you know, it's still in two figures. Though last night, I think it went up by 336 positive cases at one go. But the issue is people have always been saying that the numbers can be misleading because India has not been testing as aggressively as countries like South Korea. So there may be a lot of people going around who are positive but have not shown symptoms or have not gone into the hospitals to be tested. There aren't that many testing centers, or there weren't that many testing centers around here. So even in Calcutta, where I am, there were only a couple of places where you could go to get tested. And mostly people would get turned away and said, just self-quarantine yourself at home. And one of the initial cases that sort of came to light in Kolkata in the first case was, in fact, a young man who had gone to England and had been around people who tested positive. He came back and he didn't want to go into a government-operated infectious diseases center because he was scared of the facilities and thought they would be too squalid and shabby. And he didn't go, and he refused. He was told to go twice. He refused to go. And eventually, 3 days later, he was forced to go and he tested positive. But in the meantime, people were scrambling to find out how many people he had come in contact with. So the testing is low, which is, I think, probably part of the reason why India decided to crack down with an iron fist, as you said, because for them, because in part of the lack of testing, they wanted to sort of preempt the number of cases as far as they could and sort of seal the country off in order to contain it the best they could. Because, you know, if the Pandora's box were to open, the hospitals would get overwhelmed very, very fast.
Sandeep, Al Jazeera reports that India is converting railway carriages into isolation wards for corona patients. There are worries that hospitals may run out of space, doctors and equipment. Some healthcare workers there report being given sunglasses instead of actual protective gear.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, right now, I was talking to some doctor friends, and right now, more supplies have been coming in. But it is true that many people are sort of operating by the seat of their pants. And some people have been disappointed with the prime minister that when he gave us videotape message to the nation today. And instead of talking about measures that we were going to take, he just sort of made it a kind of a rah-rah cheerleading rally where he said on Sunday, at 9 o'clock, let us all for 9 minutes turn off our lights and light candles and lamps in order to show that we are all in this together, which is great as a sort of a symbolic gesture, perhaps, but doesn't do anything to address people's concerns about things like tests, safety equipment, whether there are enough doctors. And the real tragedy of this has been also that because of lack of equipment, some doctors themselves are getting ostracized and stigmatized in their own communities, where people are saying that landlords have been known to have kicked out tenants who were doctors or nurses because they're afraid that they might have been exposed to corona.
Yeah, Sandeep, the BBC had a piece. The headline is India Doctors Spat At and Attacked. So can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, that has been a horrible thing. So, when India announced the lockdown, right before that, the prime minister actually had on a Sunday, he said, I want the whole country at 5 o'clock on Sunday to come out and at 5 o'clock for 5 minutes to come out onto your balconies and applaud the doctors, blow conch shells. If you don't have conch shells, bring a metal vessel from somewhere in your house and beat on it like a drum, and it show your appreciation for doctors. And that was followed by with great gusto all over the nation. And within days of that, within hours of that, you started hearing reports about doctors being discriminated against, doctors being cast or thrown out of their houses, doctors being abused. And now the latest case that you were talking about are some healthcare workers who went into an area where they were doing contact tracing for some people who might have been exposed to the virus. And they found themselves faced with a lot of hostility, where some women said they were manhandled, people were spat on, and there's a lot of suspicion because they sometimes people feel that the doctors are here to basically take them away and lock them up in hospitals and things like that. And they don't want the doctors there because they feel like they'll be separated from their families.
Today, we're speaking with journalist Sandeep Roy. He's joining us from Calcutta. Sandeep is also author of the novel Don't Let Him Go. And a couple of years ago, Sandeep, I don't know how long it's been. I'm so bad with time these days. But Sandeep used to also be a co-host of Your Call. If you have any...
It's been eight years.
8 years. Oh my gosh, you've been gone for that long. Wow. Well, if you have any questions for Sandeep or comments, if you have connections to India and you'd like to talk about what your family, friends are dealing with, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Sandeep, let's talk about the estimated 100 million internal migrants in India. They are traveling very long distances from remote villages, seeking work in cities to support their families. And I understand that the lockdown was announced and a lot of people were trapped. According to Al Jazeera, thousands fled on foot to their villages, leading to the death of at least 20 people.
Yeah, that has been like one of the real tragic stories of this lockdown. I mean, I won't say the lockdown came entirely as a surprise to anybody. There had been signs leading up to it, but for example, for immigrants who were not the internal immigrants, the immigrants who were based in places like California and UK and stuff, many of them started coming back to India because there was a rumor that international flights would be stopped. And the government has, in fact, evacuated Indians who have been stuck in Italy, for example, and then brought them back to India. But these internal migrants are people that people just seem to have forgotten entirely about and didn't take into account when the lockdown was announced. So there, as you said, there are millions of Indians who have moved to cities like Bombay or Mumbai or Delhi to look for work. They work in construction, they work in restaurants. They are in ways the backbone of the country to keep it running. But they are day laborers. So as soon as offices shut, businesses shut, their employment also shut. So they're not getting money. So many of them panicked and wanted to return to the villages they were from, where at least they knew they had a roof over their heads and access to food. And you have to also understand that unlike United States, Social Security, whatever we have in India, does not migrate to the place you're at. So their Social Security, like the ration card they might use to get food, is still in the village. They are in the city. So when the economic opportunity dries up into the city, they have to fall back on their Social Security and they want to go home. And they started to go home and they discovered that the trains had been stopped for probably the first time in India's history. And trains are the lifeline of the country. So trains were stopped, buses were stopped, and suddenly these people were faced with a situation where they had no money to stay on in the cities where they were working and no modes of transport to get back to their home, which was literally across the country, hundreds and hundreds of kilometers away. So many of them just started walking on foot along the highway. And somebody I was talking to said, I don't think since the partition of India in 1947, when thousands streamed across the border from what is now Pakistan to India and vice versa, have you seen this kind of chain of people just walking doggedly on the highway, just trying to get home? And he said, at least during the time of partition, the trains were still running. in this case, there was nothing available. And there have been really a lot of tragic stories of people who have just died in the middle of the journey. And there, it was one story that I was reading in the Indian Express of a 39-year-old man, and the last phone call he makes home, and he's so exhausted, they feel like he's probably lying down on the highway and talking to them and gasping. And he just finally, and they keep saying, like, can't you find an ambulance or somebody who will get you part of the way? And he just finally, all he can say, he's just silent. And all he can say in the end is, if you can, come and get me. And then there's nothing more. And then they next discover his body in a morgue. And, you know, these are these really tragic stories that have been come out. You know, 20 people who've been mowed down by trucks on the highway because they've been walking down these highways. And you have to also understand that the state borders have been sealed. So it's as if you can no longer now go from California to Oregon or California to Nevada because you're getting stopped. So people are desperately trying to cross multiple state borders to get back to the village that they were from. Finally, the government has swung into action and, you know, and tried to arrange buses. But even then, that was kind of a crazy scene where thousands and thousands of people were trying to crowd into about 60 or 70 buses. Like, there were 10 to 15,000 workers who were trying to get into 60 or 70 buses. That resulted in a sort of near stampede, and the police are beating people up with batons. And in a way, you think the irony of all of this is that you're trying to do this in order to make people practice social distancing, and you've ended up in a stampede-like situation. But all of that, those visuals have kind of vanished from the screen now because the government has told the Supreme Court that no migrant is still on the road, that they've all either been sent to the place they're from or they've been put in shelters. But in a way, this was a tragedy that I think was eminently avoidable if just like international immigrants were given the chance to come back before flights were shut, if some facilities had been done for migrants to either figure out whether they wanted to stay back in the cities they were or buses and trains provided to take them home before the country locked down.
Wow. And we should say, Sandeep, the name of the 38-year-old you mentioned who passed is Ranveer Singh. And you sent us this article before the show in Indian Express, and we'll put a link at yourcallradio.org. Sandeep, when we're talking about all of these low-wage migrant workers, do they get much attention? I mean, right now, there, as you said, there's a lot of stories about the tragedies and just what they're facing, not getting home, not having enough to eat. But in non-emergency times, do they get much attention in the media in India?
Not at all. In India, and I would include myself in this, if you talk about a migrant, you will think about a person who is working in Silicon Valley or is a doctor in England or at the most a laborer or a nurse in the Middle East, in the Gulf countries. You will never really associate the word migrant with somebody who is an internal migrant who has moved from one part of India to look for work. And these are mostly cyclical migrants, as in they go there, they live for 9 to 10 months, and they may then come back to the village during sowing season to sow their crops and stuff. And then they go back to work as whatever security guards or construction laborers and all of that. And the tragedy, part of the tragedy of all of this is at this time is when people would be coming back for the sowing season. So in some ways, the economic repercussions of what is happening are going to be felt for a while. And I was talking to a professor who has been studying Indian migration named Chinmay Tumbe. And he said the same thing sort of actually happened during the 1918 influenza pandemic, which killed thousands and thousands of people in India. And the first people who fled were the migrants. And then when the pandemic receded, there was actually a period when these cities, construction, and all of these jobs in the city suffered greatly because the people who starved, the laborers who worked there, were gone. And it took a while for everything to pick up. So I think we will feel the aftershock of this. And it is tragedy. It is tragic because, for example, if I am an overseas migrant, there is a branch of the ministry that is devoted to my needs that has been set up a few years ago. There's actually one day a year which is called the International Immigrant Day, when the, you know, immigrant achievers are felicitated. There's a ministry that is in charge of it. When Indian Indians get into trouble abroad, there's no who to go to. When a migrant, internal migrant in Bombay gets into trouble, you know, because of a pandemic or just a fire or a flood or something like that, there is really nobody to turn to because he's sort of no longer the responsibility of the place he's from as well as the place he's at, because his, you know, he lives in one place, but his vote is in another place.
Sandeep, here in the United States, as you know, so many systems are broken, and there is now a very bright spotlight on broken systems, whether it's in healthcare, you know, the people needing food, the students who rely on school for food. And I'm wondering, is the same thing happening in India? Because it is such a big country with a very healthy civil society, so many incredible activists there. You know, a lot of people here are saying, once we get through this, we cannot go back to normal. Are you having those conversations and hearing those conversations in India?
I'm afraid, Rose, I have to say I'm not hearing as much of it as one would think there would be. In India, a lot of it, there is much more conversation, and that is partly about, you know, rallying together, and as a nation, we must resist this pandemic. And in a way, there has been, and it is not specific to what is happening with COVID right now, but there has been over the past several years a tendency to quickly brand any criticism of systems in India as something anti-national and unpatriotic, and as if you are questioning the idea of India itself. And so part of that is, like, I hear very little criticism of it, and that's partly because the ruling party here is very strong. The opposition is very fragmented and weak and has been further weakened in the last national election, so they don't really have much to say. And the leader of the opposition, Rahul Gandhi, was in fact out of the country when some of this was breaking, you know, past agitations were breaking. So it's kind of a bit of a leaderless opposition in some ways. So there's not as much talk, but the professor I was talking to said was hopeful that at least as a result of this, policies would be instituted to take care of the welfare of migrants, and migrants would at least finally find some mention on the government's agenda. Because this government, actually, unlike other governments, has in fact studied the issue of internal migrants, but right now, but they haven't really followed up on it, you know, about how maybe if you move to Mumbai, your ration card can move with you and you can access food and supplies there. You know, some basic reforms like this, maybe some of those will happen as a result of this.
Well, Sandeep, thank you so much for joining us. Any final thoughts on media coverage of COVID-19 in India?
I think a lot of it has, you know, in some ways, journalists, doctors have been kind of in the forefront of it. In they are going out and covering this at considerable risk to their own lives. And I think right now the coverage has been largely about how this lockdown is being implemented and the impact of the lockdown. And, you know, journalists have walked a mile with the migrants trying to cover their stories. Barkha Dutt did that, and her piece appeared in the Washington Post not so long ago. So in that sense, there is that. But I think right now the focus has been entirely on, right now the lockdown has been announced for 21 days till about April 14th. And nobody is very sure as to what is going to happen after April 14th, whether the lockdown will be lifted. We've been hearing stories about that it'll be a sort of a staggered lifting of the lockdown. But the point is that, you know, after 21 days of lockdown, it's not like on 22nd day we can say that the country is virus-free and everybody can go back to business as usual. In some ways, the real danger is going to be when this lockdown lifts and there is perhaps a false sense of security among people who want to then rush out and try and go back to business as usual, and they can't really do that. So I think that has been sort of the focus on trying to educate people about that, that this is actually, whether or not the lockdown ends now or it ends in May, and different sort of scenarios and algorithms have been put out there, that no matter what happens, this is going to be a much more long drawn out story than just what is right now the story of a country under lockdown.
Well, Sandeep, it's great to hear your voice. Thank you so much for joining us. We'd love to have you back in a few weeks.
Thank
and
you.
Please stay safe, you and your family, and stay healthy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sandeep Roy is a journalist and author of the novel Don't Let Him Go, and you can find the articles we referenced at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a short break, we will talk about Amazon, Instacart, and Whole Foods workers who went on strike this week over health and safety concerns. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or question on the website at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, it's 1A from WAMU in Washington, and a further wrap-up of the week's news. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about the Amazon, Whole Foods, and Instacart workers who walked off the job this week over health and safety concerns. We will hear from a few workers who say they do not feel safe on the job. And then later in the show, we will talk about the increased demand for food in the United States. And joining us now is Mike Elk, a labor reporter and founder of the grassroots website Payday Report, where they focus on very important labor issues happening across the country. Hi, Mike. Welcome back to the show.
It's great to be on the show as always, Rose. You're one of the few shows that really gets organizing.
Well, thank you so much, Mike. It's great to hear your voice. We're also joined by Arthur Delaney, senior reporter for HuffPost, where he covers politics and the economy. Hi, Arthur. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back. It is a good show.
Well, thank you. And it's great to hear your voice, Arthur. Arthur, I want to start off with you. You've got a new story up called Government's $2 trillion coronavirus response stumbles out of the gate. Can you tell us, there's so much conflicting information out there about when people can see this money in their bank account. What are you finding?
The money that's going into people's bank accounts will be in most people's bank accounts this month. This is one of the most important parts of the big coronavirus relief bill that Congress passed just a week ago. But there's some problems for people who don't already have direct deposit set up with the IRS because they haven't filed a tax return in the last 2 years. Those people are still eligible, but at first the Treasury Department was saying you're going to have to file a tax return. And it turned out, I talked to dozens of people who are low income on Social Security, that they could not make TurboTax or H&R Block software work for them, because if you didn't have taxable income, just wouldn't let you file electronically. So this was a disaster in the making. So they came out and said, actually, we will just figure out how to get this money to you. And so that category of people who are on Social Security will be treated like others who have already filed their returns and will get the benefits in a few weeks. That's going to leave out millions of households who have to file, and they might not see the benefits for months.
For months.
That's right. I mean, they can only process and cut so many checks per week, and the estimate that Democrats in Congress have gotten is that it could take weeks and weeks and weeks to finish sending all the money to people who are eligible, who manage to file tax returns. Some people, I think, people on Social Security income will not automatically get benefits and will have a hard time dealing with the software, especially when all the tax clinics are closed. And you might not have a working printer in your house, but you're supposed to stay away from everybody. So what are you going to do? It's a really tough situation, I think, for a lot of people of modest means.
Right. Mike, you have been contacting workers. You're on the ground. You're connected. What are you hearing from people? I mean, 3 months to receive this $1,200?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people are really scared. There's not enough money coming out fast enough, and it's going to be a big issue. And There was an article the other day about how many states still require unemployment workers to come into the office to physically process claims. So this is going to be a long, slow process, and it's going to be interesting to see what kind of organizing happens around it, because it's clear that there are many, many holes in the system. Some of those holes in terms of the expansion of unemployment to freelancers and gig workers is starting to become somewhat fixed, or at least they're attempting to fix them. And, you know, I think we're entering a new era where I think we're going to have a much larger debate about how the social safety net is formed.
Yeah, exactly. And I just want to mention this. The IRS is out with some information about scams. The IRS says it will not call you asking to verify or provide your financial information. They already are hearing about scams over email, over the phone, over text. So be sure and do not answer any of those calls or texts, because the IRS will not get in touch with you to verify your financial information. And I mean, Arthur, it's really important, especially to pass this on to older people.
Yeah, it's amazing how these scams work. They're so depraved. But I have been in touch with a lot of people, and they need actually just basic information, and you can understand why they'd be so vulnerable to scams. Like, 100 people emailed me saying, "What do? I can't make TurboTax work." So I'll just repeat, if you're on Social Security, the government's going to figure out how to get you the money without you having to do anything, because of course they already have the direct deposit information. But there's going to need to be a solution, a workaround for other people who are not on Social Security to be able to receive these checks. And we're still waiting for the Treasury Department and the IRS to announce what that workaround is going to be, because you can, right now it doesn't work to file a tax return through the free online software that's available if you don't have any taxable income. So this is just one of the big problems that the federal government is having right now, trying to move this brand new set of policies that Congress put into law just a week ago.
Right. We're also hearing in various states, like California, for example, Governor Newsom is waiving certain reporting requirements for food stamps, so people will not have to prove how much money they earn to continue getting food stamps, and you can find information at getcalfresh.org. Mike, what else are you hearing from workers who've lost their jobs or whose hours have been cut? Because, I mean, we're just seeing long lines of people waiting in their cars to get food. I believe that you tweeted, you did actually, what you saw right outside of Pittsburgh, and then in Sacramento, people were waiting in very long lines to get food. What else can you tell us about that?
Well, I think people are desperate. And, you know, there was a food bank here in Pittsburgh that opened, and they flew a helicopter overhead of the line to get into the food bank, and it was 6 miles long almost.
Wow.
You know, well, not 6 miles. I mean, it was several miles, I think six, but it was definitely several miles long. Six is an exaggeration, but it was definitely, you know, a couple miles long. And I think people were at a point of deep desperation that there are no other alternatives. And I think this is really beginning to lead people to answer and ask some questions that they haven't asked in the past. I mean, look at other nations where, you know, in Europe, they're giving money straight to, you know, employers to keep people on the payroll, at least at 80-90% payroll level, right? Which, you know, taking a 10-20% haircut is really tough, but it's not nearly as tough as asking, you know, people to take, you know, in some instances, very deep cuts to get unemployment. So, you know, you're seeing a bigger, broader conversation. And I think, as Arthur and other people point out, what we've tried to do here in the States is this payroll protection loans, that you're supposed to get these low-interest loans if you keep people on the payroll, and that they'll be forgivable later on. You know, there's been all kind of problems already with the rollout of that, who qualifies, who doesn't, and banks setting their own rules. So I think what's happening here is that the lack of a social safety net here is being clearly laid out as being broken. And the question is, what's going to happen next? And it's interesting that we're getting into a huge new wave of strikes that we haven't seen. You know, we were already getting into a big strike wave in the U.S. Last year, we saw the highest number of strikes that we've seen in more than a decade in the U.S. You know, the teacher strikes were massive. And now, you know, the labor movement has definitely been building up a lot of militancy with Fight for 15 strikes, with teacher strikes, with strikes elsewhere. And now, all of a sudden, you know, you're seeing a lot of low-wage workers, grocery store workers, transit workers, home health care aides, being seen as heroes and getting raises. You know, a lot of supermarkets are giving out $2 an hour raises. So workers are taking advantage of this. I mean, there's a record number of strikes. People upset about lack of hazard pay, about lack of protective gears. Workers are taking advantage of this to get new demands met. And the question is, how much does that energy carry into getting the social safety net in this country changed? And then I think that's going to be an interesting question.
Right.
Mike just said so much smart stuff. So regarding the way they're doing wage subsidies in Europe, where like the Netherlands, for example, is picking up as much as 90% of a firm's payroll, the Paycheck Protection Program that was in the coronavirus relief bill is essentially a program just like that, where the government essentially assumes the salaries plus other expenses of small businesses in the United States for 8 weeks. And they do this through a forgivable loan where you only have to pay the loan if you wind up firing people or slashing their pay. So it is potentially a huge deal. And like Mike was saying, it hints at a much broader possible conversation about the way we run our country, with businesses the main source of health insurance and other necessary benefits. But this program was supposed to launch today, and banks have just sort of said no, and they have not been taking applications. I'm hearing from dozens of business owners who are desperate to apply because they've already laid people off or are about to start laying people off, and this is something the government has done before. They'll just say, we're going to help people, but we're going to funnel the policy through banks, and then we're not going to control the banks in any way. So the first day, the first like 12 hours of this policy have been a disaster. It still has tons of promise on paper, and it'll be really interesting to see in the coming weeks how well it works. Because like Mike said, I think it's got major implications for the way we run our society.
Arthur Delaney is senior reporter for HuffPost, covering politics and the economy, and Mike Elk is a labor reporter and founder of Payday Report. A really incredible grassroots site covering labor across the country. Let's talk about the strikes that we've seen this week. Instacart, Amazon, and Whole Foods workers went on strike over health and safety concerns. And I just want to play a clip from Amazon workers in Ramelius, Michigan, where at least two people tested positive for COVID-19. And in this clip, you will hear the voices of Mario Chippen and Ryan Stepney. And thanks to Bloomberg for this clip. And here it is.
You're not really doing social distancing. There's about 500 to 600 people in the building on a daily basis. Sometimes in some areas, we are shoulder to shoulder.
All we want for them to do is shut the building off for 2 weeks with pay so they could deep clean the building.
We need Jeff Bezos to take action, and I invite Jeff Bezos to visit his facility and do something about this.
Thanks to Bloomberg for that clip. Two Amazon workers in Ramelius, Michigan, and I just want to grab their names here. Let's see. We've got Mario Chippen and Ryan Stepney. Mike, there were strikes across the country at Payday Report. You report on nurses in Western Pennsylvania walking off the job after 42 people tested positive. And then you have another report: after 10 workers get COVID-19, 1,000 meat packers walk off the job in Colorado. So it seems like this is pretty broad.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing, obviously, there was a large strike this week at Instacart where workers are demanding protective equipment and hazard pay, as well as, you know, there's been a strike at Amazon and at Whole Foods. And it's interesting to note Instacart, because right now, you know, in California, you passed AB 5, which granted employee rights to Instacart drivers. So, you know, now Instacart drivers would be able to get unemployment insurance and workers' comp, which is important, because if you get sick driving someone, you would qualify for workers' comp in some places, potentially. There's all kind of things that you get when you become an employee and not an independent contractor. So instead of Uber and Instacart and these other rideshare gig apps getting people those resources, making them employees, they're instead spending $120 million to run a ballot initiative to overturn the California Supreme Court decision, which set up AB 5. So, you know, they have $120 million lying around, but they're going to use it instead fighting their workers. And they're not the only company that's doing this. Trader Joe's is actively running an anti-union campaign right now because there's a lot of union talk now at Trader Joe's. You know, 450,000 Kroger supermarket workers nationwide all got $2 an hour raises because they were unionized. Safeway workers got raises. Workers here at Giant Eagle in Pittsburgh got raises. HEB, non-union workers in Texas got raises. So, you know, workers are on the march right now. And some companies, you know, like Safeway and these other grocery chains, and even another example is the supermarket, not supermarket, but market, gas station market chain, Sheetz, just gave all of its employees $3 an hour. They're 100% non-union. So right now, companies realize that their employees are valued more than ever. They're scared of keeping their employees because, you know, most people don't want to risk their lives for a job that doesn't pay very much, so they're handing out big raises. And so what's happening now is that power has shifted back into workers' hands. We saw this week here in Pittsburgh, right outside of Pittsburgh in Beaver County, there was a strike of nurses, members of SEIU Healthcare Pennsylvania, who walked off the job after 36 patients tested positive for COVID at a nursing home. Two of them died. Six nurses got it, and they had no protective equipment, no N95s or anything like that there. In Colorado, 10 workers working on a meatpacking line. Meatpacking line, you're really close to one another. You're touching the meat. There's all kind of germs everywhere. Walk off the assembly line after, you know, people tested positive. And that was a really impressive walk out there because that's a heavily immigrant workforce. One of the union reps said that there's over 27 languages spoken among the union members there. So workers are banding together in ways they haven't in the past. And we saw it last week in Pittsburgh when garbage workers went out on strike. Bus drivers in Birmingham have gone out. Purdue chicken workers in Georgia. Ship workers in Maine. We had another small walkout this week of auto part assembly workers in Alabama. Workers typically are scared of going on illegal strikes because they're scared of losing their jobs. Well, people are a lot more scared of losing their lives than their jobs. And so people are taking action. And the thing is, once workers realize they have a lot of power, it's tough to tell them they no longer have that power. They gain a sense of confidence. They gain a sense of know-how of how to do these things. They gain a sense of solidarity. And once you open that box, it's tough to take back in. And I think in many ways, what we saw happen with the teacher strikes is a preview of a kind of new power that's going to start spreading to these frontline workers. You know, before the teacher strikes happened, teachers were seen as, you know, in the media discourse, at least in the elite media discourse, as not very worthy of public sympathy, as fat cats who bled off of the system. And then the teacher strikes happened and they got 80% support in these states and people realized, wow, communities really support teachers. What's happening now with grocery store workers and healthcare workers and, transit workers and warehouse workers is the same thing. People are appreciating so much the workers that are going out and risking their lives. In a lot of cities, there's big standing rounds of applause. And once people realize how much community support they have paired with that much solidarity, that's a very powerful combination. And I don't know what's going to happen legislatively, but I've been around the labor movement long enough to be able to tell you that you're going to see a big strike wave happening in this country, and it's not going to stop for some time to come.
Arthur, what would you add?
I think Mike's totally right about the way corporate America is sort of playing with fire right now. My colleague Dave Jamison did a story in which an expert on labor movement said there's just hot shops everywhere, which means workplaces that are rife with dissatisfaction because you put a deadly virus in the mix and it's totally exposed unfair treatment that, workers have been receiving from, the labor market for years. The only possibly mitigating thing I would think to add is that we are about to see unemployment skyrocket, and the strikes that happened last year had a lot to do with the fact that there were fewer unemployed workers waiting around to take someone's job if they were unsatisfied. The labor market was tighter, and employers had more leverage because of that. Right now, they have more leverage in the sectors where we obviously need them doing their jobs. But it could become a different situation if the social distancing measures sort of let up a little bit and we've got like above 10% employment. In that scenario, there's going to be a lot of unemployed people waiting around. And I don't know what it will be like, because I'm sure we'll still have this virus going around, but the underlying dynamic of the labor market and the number of people who are available to take jobs might be a little different.
What are your thoughts on that, Mike?
Well, I think it's certainly going to be an issue. If there is big unemployment after this, what kind of leverage are workers going to have? And I think, you know, the one thing that we saw in the 1930s that we didn't see so much of in the 2008 recession is unemployed worker organizing. How much of that is going to be going on? There was just a huge expansion of unemployment. You can now get an additional $600 a week. So for some people, that can cover salary up until about $45,000. So I think with that big expansion, people are going to be fighting for it. So there is going to be some organizing of the unemployed. But if we don't go out as a labor movement and organize the unemployed, you know, there's going to be a lot of people that are going to risk scabbing. I mean, look at Amazon. They fired a warehouse worker. Look at Trader Joe's. They're fighting a union drive. There are corporations where the people that head them are pathological. They're pathological profit seekers. They will do anything to get profits. So there are going to be corporations that are going to try to take advantage of that. They're going to do ugly things. You know, Arthur brings up Dave Jameson, who's been writing about a chain of fabric stores that have stayed open. You know, there are people, Joanne Fabrics, there are people that will do anything to make profit. So you're going to see that, and it's going to be tough. And so it's really going to lead to a bigger debate about the social safety net and about expanding and keeping those unemployment insurance benefits. Because for some people, the amount that they got, that they're able to get under unemployment now has almost tripled from about, you know, average of $300 a month, give or take, to now, you know, $900 a month, $300 a week, now up to about $900 a week. So keeping and organizing around that social safety net is going to be key to not, you know, creating a situation where unemployed workers are going to want to scab.
And we're just getting an update from the LA Times. They report that Walt Disney is going to furlough employees. They employ 223,000 people. It's one of the biggest employers in the LA area. They didn't say how many people would be out of work because of this decision. Arthur, when people get furloughed, what happens to their health care?
They can lose. To be honest, I'm not certain if there's a one-size-fits-all answer to that question, but they can lose their health care. And like Mike said, I think the policies that they just put into this bill are pointing to a broader debate. Lots of people, I mean, all the millions of people are getting laid off. They're losing their health care. It's possible that private insurance could just fall apart. Like, you'll lose so many healthy people in your insurance market that the business no longer works. It clearly points to this sort of universal health care proposals that people like Bernie Sanders have been campaigning on. I think that the labor market disruption we're going to see is just going to further highlight the criticisms that have been made for decades and make people a lot more interested in getting a government solution where the private sector is just going to drop the ball.
You know, I ask this, Mike, because I know a lot of people work at Disneyland, especially older people, specifically for the health care.
It's, you know, it's going to be a big deal. You know, this is completely exposed how terrible our health care system is. What, 10 million people have filed for unemployment? It means those most of those people are without health care right now. You know, we need a better system here. I mean, I run a small business. I pay $500 a month to get health care. You know, it's ridiculous. If I had $500 a month, you know, I could go out and buy a house or something. You know, I live in Pittsburgh. It's not unrealistic for somebody to buy a house here, you know. But, you know, the health care, it just costs so much.
Yeah, and BuzzFeed reports that Trump will not open the Obamacare markets during the coronavirus outbreak. 11 states plus the District of Columbia are allowing a special open enrollment period, but the administration is declining to do this nationally. Any comments on that, Arthur?
I think that if you lose your job, it qualifies as an event where you are supposed to be able to enroll, but the Trump administration has not let up in general on regulations to cut various social policies, and it's going to look bad. I'd be surprised if they stay the course, and the idea that you would not try to help people connect with private health insurance at a time when millions are losing their jobs, and therefore their private health insurance is really something.
Right. Mike, we have about 30 seconds left. Are you aware of any upcoming strikes?
Well, I think you're going to see a lot more in coming days. It's not clear where it's going to happen, but I think you're going to start seeing them in the healthcare sector. Mm-hmm. People are being asked to go into ridiculous situations, particularly in nursing homes, with a lack of protective care. And I think we're going to see a lot more action in healthcare.
Mike Elk is a labor reporter and founder of Payday Report. They are a grassroots news website focusing on organizing across the country. Mike, thank you so much for joining us. I hope your dad's doing better.
He got out of the hospital yesterday. Thank God.
Okay, great. Well, we're thinking about you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks.
Arthur Delaney is a senior reporter for HuffPost covering politics and the economy. Arthur, thank you for joining us, and I hope you and your family stay safe and healthy.
Thank you. We will.
All right. Thank you. And you can find the articles that we mentioned today at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to David LaTulipe, our studio engineer, and Damian Miner, who's line producing for us today. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.